Trouble at the banks leads to trouble in the economy.
And trouble in the economy leads to trouble at the banks.
From APM, American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Tuesday, September 13th.
Coming up, can Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan save Bank of America?
Why is it that China can get infrastructure projects off the ground so much faster than we can?
And one man finally gets his chance to be a traffic cop, but he's the one getting a ticket.
Oh no, those stories and much more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The debt crisis in Europe now, and European bank stocks are feeling a lot of pressure today. Some of those banks have seen shares drop as much as 50% just in the last couple of months. And that drop in confidence means they'll add more trouble to European economies by laying off a lot of workers.
Well, if that vicious cycle sounds familiar, it's because it's happening right here in the U.S. as well. Yesterday, Bank of America confirmed that it will cut 30,000 jobs in an effort to shore up its finances. For more on the troubles at Bank of America, we're joined in the studio by Paul Barrett, who interviewed the company's CEO for this week's cover story in Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Paul Barrett, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, why are the problems at Bank of America so much worse than the problems at the other big banks?
Bank of America has two distinctive problems. One is Countrywide Financial, the subprime mortgage factory that it bought in 2008. There's tremendous legal uncertainty surrounding the many, many lawsuits that have been filed against Countrywide and against Bank of America, and the market simply doesn't understand what the potential liability is. Uncertainty is something the market hates. Second thing is Bank of America is bigger and more intertwined with the American economy than any of its rivals. So it is basically a mirror of the American economy, and as long as unemployment is stuck above 9% and the housing market is depressed, Bank of America will struggle.
Well, you spoke with the CEO, Brian Moynihan. What is he feeling about all of this?
Well, Moynihan believes that he came in with a clear plan to take the bank that he inherited and shrink it down, make it much more focused on its consumers, on companies, and on institutional investors. So he expresses a lot of confidence. The problem is that he's untested as a CEO. He was kind of a battlefield promotion in crisis in late 2009, and Wall Street has expressed in the way that it does uncertainty about whether he has the talent to lead the bank out of trouble.
Well, do you think, after having met with him, that he's got what it takes to get this bank back on its footing?
Moynihan is probably underestimated in terms of his skill and understanding. I think he's a very solid operations person. The reason he may be underestimated is he's simply not that good at communicating. He has a distinct lack of public charisma. And while people tend to discount that kind of thing, in his case, it actually has been very important. He has been unable to persuade Wall Street that the bank is on the right track. So it's a situation where leadership and style actually are playing an important role.
That's Paul Barrett, who interviewed Brian Moynihan, and he's got the cover story in this week's Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks so much for joining us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Well, President Obama today goes to Columbus, Ohio to pitch his American Jobs Bill. It's a piece of legislation that started on the congressional path to who knows where. And the president will visit a high school that recently renovated some classrooms to underscore the need to spend on schools and infrastructure. Marketplace's David Gura is now with us from Washington with the latest on how much that program, the jobs program, is going to cost. Morning, David.
Hey, Steve.
Now, the president says the plan's not going to add a dime to the deficit. Where's the money going to come from?
Right, well, the plan, as it's written, would cost about $450 billion. Now, the president says it'd be easy to come up with that kind of money if the government were to change the tax code. President Obama says companies and wealthier Americans making more than $200,000 a year, families making more than $250,000 a year, they get too many deductions. He says there are too many loopholes. And if we were to limit those, cut some of those, that'd be worth about $470 billion. So more money, actually, than the president's job plan would cost.
So where, David, does the plan go from here? I mean, is it up to Congress to vote on it? Or does it go to this super committee, the one that's going to be trying to cut the long-term deficit, right, the super committee?
Well, that super committee, six Democrats and six Republicans, it meets today. And remember, they're charged with finding a way to cut more than $1 trillion over the next decade. Depending on what Congress does with the president's bill, this jobs plan could wind up on their plate as well. The president could conceivably ask them to find a way to work it into their overall decision. Either way, the White House says that later this month, the president's going to suggest his own debt reduction plan. And President Obama had this message for Congress yesterday.
No games, no politics, no delays.
No chance?
It was a long summer. I don't need to remind you of that, but full of partisanship.
Yes, it was.
I think it's pretty unlikely Congress is going to pass the president's package as is. But I talked to Alice Rivlin. She was on the president's special commission to reduce the deficit. And she told me she's still optimistic.
We need to have strong job creation now and a much larger package over future years, bringing down the growth in deficits.
Rivlin told me Washington has to find a way to focus on both the short term and the long term if we want the economy to recover.
All right, Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. David, thanks.
Thank you.
Now let's get to the consumer. We're going to look at two companies that reported their quarterly earnings this morning and see what they can tell us about consumer spending. Julie Niemann is an analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis, as she is every Tuesday. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with Best Buy. We saw this morning profit last quarter down 30%. What's the story there?
Well, the recession is still taking a toll on the consumer. We're very cost conscious. We go to Best Buy and browse and then compare online on your cell phone. Shop at Amazon then. No sales tax. Walmart and Costco, they have very limited selection but huge price advantages. The one bright spot, though, were mobile phones with every bell and whistle on them. The economy may be in the tank, but you're not going to give up anything else but your iPhone and Android and whatever. There was a recent survey that's in the London Science Museum that said things you can't live without. The sun, the internet, water, Facebook, and toilets. We do have our priorities.
That's a good list. All right, well, let's talk about Cracker Barrel. This is this restaurant chain I think of as, you know, the big, huge breakfast right along the highway. Their same-store sales were down 1.4%, profit down 36%. What's going on there?
Well, Cracker Barrel is not a high-end restaurant. It's middle America goes there, and it's not a destination restaurant, but it's on the road. Now, with gasoline over $3 and a quarter a gallon, there are fewer trips out there. If you go from St. Louis to Kansas City, you used to stop off at Cracker Barrel about mid-trip. You get your fried chicken and your country store tchotchkes. Now you gas up and go at Quick Trip with a hot dog and cheaper low-octane gas. This is a huge honking recession. It's crushed the consumer, and we're simply spending very, very carefully.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, Jeremy, Julie, Maserati said today it's going to make an SUV in Detroit, partially out of Jeep parts. Now, Fiat owns Chrysler and Jeep, which, of course, have plants in Motor City.
Import prices, Steve, in the U.S. fell by 0.5% in August thanks to lower fuel and food costs and lower industrial material prices. But the government said today export prices rose by about the same margin. One more thing, Steve. Did you know that the average size of a home that was built last year, even amid the housing downturn, is 650 square feet bigger than it was in 1980? That's according to the Census Bureau.
I think that's because we're all 650 square foot bigger.
That could be.
No, I'm much bigger than I was back in 1980. We've got more business news, by the way, anytime at our website, marketplace.org.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Well, now to the Marketplace global perspective and the European debt crisis. There are fears that the Greek debt problems will spread across the continent and fast.
Next door in Italy, that country's been working to raise revenues to avoid having to be bailed out by the European Union or the International Monetary Fund. And Italy is now looking to China for help. From our European desk, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The head of China's sovereign wealth fund was reportedly in Rome last week. He was there to discuss the possibility of buying Italian government bonds. That gave financial markets quite a boost. A Chinese wall of money might be just the thing to stop the downward spiral in the eurozone. But doubts are creeping in. Steve Barrow is a currency strategist with Standard Bank.
there's quite a lot of speculation in the market that China has actually not committed to this, and that's putting more pressure on the Italian bond market and, as a consequence of that, on stock markets and on the euro.
He points out there's also been talk of the Chinese buying Greek government bonds, but that's hardly helped the Greeks. Markets indicate there's now a 98% chance of the government in Athens defaulting. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, China may be looking to spend money in Italy. It's also been pouring a ton of cash at home to build up its infrastructure with things such as high-speed rail. And as the president today, as we mentioned, goes to Ohio to pitch his own infrastructure plan, this morning we look at how China gets its projects off the ground so quickly. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz is now with us from Shanghai to talk about it. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Steve.
How is building infrastructure in China different than in here in the U.S.?
Well, China's at a completely different stage in its development as a country than where the U.S. is. The U.S. is largely built out, but there are parts of China that aren't yet connected to a road. So that's part of the reason China's fast-tracking all this development.
And that's why we've seen high-speed trains appear so quickly in China?
Yeah, I mean, 5 years ago, China didn't even have high-speed trains. Today, China has the largest high-speed rail network in the world. I talked to China economist Arthur Kroeber today about all of this, and he said you wouldn't see this kind of pace in the U.S. because environmental and property laws would hold up the whole process. He said Chinese leaders are worried about the same thing coming their way.
People will have more environmental concerns. There will be more secure property rights, so people will not just say it's fine for you to demolish our village so that you can build a highway through it.
So in a way, China's government sees that it has a window in which it can build all these huge projects. But this summer's high-speed rail crash got many people here thinking that all this rapid development isn't such a good idea. So it's becoming clear that this window is starting to close.
Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz in Shanghai. Rob, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, in Australia today, the parliament introduced a plan to price greenhouse gas emissions. Critics are worried about what it'll do to the cost of living down under. But as Stuart Cohen reports from Sydney, it could get the ball rolling for other countries that want to limit carbon emissions.
Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard's ambitious plan would put a price of $23 per metric ton on greenhouse gas emissions. The country's 500 biggest polluting companies would foot the bill and give much of the money to individuals to compensate for higher costs of energy and consumer goods. After 3 years, the plan would move to a cap-and-trade system, similar to the one that failed in the U.S. last year. Professor Natalie Stoyanov of the University of Technology in Sydney says Australia's plan may spur other countries to limit carbon emissions.
Well, I certainly think it would have an impact. We do have a bit of clout in Southeast Asia and the Pacific generally. And I think we're already seeing nations thinking about what they can do to improve things.
The U.S. and Australia typically have close ties, but Professor Stoyanov says whether this will give a jumpstart to American efforts to price carbon emissions depends on who's living in the White House in 2 years' time. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
At a conference today in California, Microsoft is expected to give developers a sneak peek at its latest operating system. The company's hoping the new system with the flashy working title Windows 8 will get developers excited enough to keep pumping out applications for it. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has that.
Microsoft Windows may run on around 90% of computers, but the PC has become kind of boring.
Microsoft Windows is your father's Oldsmobile.
Tech analyst Laura DiDio says Microsoft's newest operating system is expected to rev up faster and work across multiple devices.
Now they're saying, look, if you want to run Windows on a tablet
or on a smartphone,
whatever you want, we're there for you.
Kurt Scharf of consulting group Parks Associates says that consistency across platforms is attractive to developers who want
the ability to write an application once and then it gets deployed across PC, tablet, and smartphone,
which Microsoft can then use to lure consumers with potentially cool new applications for tablets and smartphones. Scharf says it's unlikely Microsoft will overtake Apple's dominance in mobile, but
as a strong number two, I think that's something to be proud of.
There are estimates that sales of mobile devices will triple over the next few years. So maybe it is something to be proud of. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Well, a team in Nebraska says they've built a jet-powered school bus that's topped 320 miles an hour. You heard
really?
Right. A school bus, Jeremy, that's topped 320 miles an hour. That's faster than NASCAR and, you know, the Formula One and IndyCar, all of that. The team leader told CBS this week that they took an F4 fighter engine and built this bus around it to provoke interest among kids. I guess for engineering purposes, you know, see how a jet engine works. The school bus is yellow, just like most school buses are, but has big red and orange flame decals around the front.
Oh,
I love that.
Wow.
I wish I could have ridden the bus just like
yeah,
that when I was a kid.
A lot of kids are going to want to get
cool.
on that bus. Yeah.
And at full throttle, forget about the flames on the stickers up front, at full throttle, real flames come out of the rear. the bus won't be transporting kids, though. But if it were, forget about getting to school late. Because
yeah, really?
At 320 miles an hour, if you've got to be at school at like 8 o'clock, forget it. You're there at like 6:15. So
yeah, plus, you know, I don't know if I'd want to be on a bus, a school bus, going at 320 miles an hour, given the fact that they have such small leg room. It
yes.
really would be uncomfortable.
Yeah, especially at Mach 4.
A sudden stop when it pulls up next to the library would be really uncomfortable.
You can check out a video, by the way, of the school bus going really fast at marketplace.org. Check it out on our website. The U.S. House is scheduled to vote today on a near $5.5 billion deal that would avoid another Federal Aviation Administration shutdown. But a major sticking point is federal subsidies for flights out of rural airports. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer checked out one such airport in rural Maryland.
At least four times a day, a Cape Air pilot fires up a 9-seat propeller plane in Hagerstown, Maryland, and takes off for Baltimore, sometimes with no passengers aboard. The federal government pays Cape Air more than $400 per flight, about $1 million a year, passengers or no. I took the flight last Friday, and I was the only one on board.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Baltimore. Watch your step.
The subsidy program, known as Essential Air Service, was created in the 1970s to ensure that airlines served rural airports. Today, airlines at more than 150 airports get the subsidies, and it costs the federal government about $200 million a year. Critics say it's a waste of money. NYU law professor Michael E. Levine helped create the program. He says it was supposed to be temporary.
But you can really ask at a time when we're closing school libraries whether we should be spending money to provide air service that's only being used by a couple of people a day.
Over the summer, Congress agreed to cut essential air service funding at 13 airports, including Hagerstown. Phil Ridenour is the director of the Hagerstown Airport. He says taxpayers don't pay for the subsidies. They come from airline ticket and fuel taxes. And if they were eliminated, the money wouldn't go toward deficit reduction.
The money still goes to the FAA, and it would just be divvied out in another portion of an FAA program.
And Ridenour says the subsidies are essential for Hagerstown businesses. I flew back from Baltimore to Hagerstown with a small business owner. There were five of us on that flight. Chris Molesky owns the Wetsuit Warehouse in Hagerstown. He was returning from a trade show in Florida.
It's important we have an airport 5 miles away from our house, 8 miles away from our office.
Molesky says he wouldn't have gone to the trade show if he'd had to drive the hour and a half from Hagerstown to Baltimore. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Today, the full bargaining committees return to the table as negotiations continue to end the lockout in professional basketball. NBA players and owners have been fighting over how much money each side should get in a new labor deal. And of course, if they can't agree, then no NBA games. Let's get an update now from Henry Abbott of ESPN.com. He writes the True Hoop blog. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, as a casual observer of the NBA lockout, I have to say I sort of think they'll come together with some agreement by the time the season is supposed to start. Is that a wrong assumption?
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. That there was sort of a clash of the titans shaping up in the rhetoric where the league was talking about a total reboot of how they share revenue with the players. Now that it's getting down to the final few weeks before when they'd have to make a deal for the season to start, the rhetoric has gone away entirely, and the behind-the-scenes noises are that things are going very well now.
What happens if you and I are both wrong and there is a lockout and some games are missed?
Oh, I mean, it could definitely happen. And no, it's not good. The NBA has an opportunity right now to sort of move past baseball as America's second sport, and it's incredibly popular with young people playing in playgrounds all over the world, and there's a chance to become, you know, the most popular American sport in China, and to just move very solidly forward back to where the league was in the Jordan years. You know, a lockout, a missed season would be a step back in that process.
And what are the long-term effects of a lockout?
Well, the NBA has a particular moment right now where they have what they've always wanted, which is some very attractive young stars like Derrick Rose and Kevin Durant. And it seems like, based on TV ratings, America's coming around to really getting to like those players. When you lock them out, you demonize them a bit. The whole idea is to sort of show through the media that these players are spoiled and shouldn't be, you know, respected as much. And as soon as they get back in business, they want those players to be loved again. So it's a little bit of a marketing problem to have them locked out.
Henry Abbott is a senior writer with ESPN.com. He writes the True Hoop blog. Henry, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And finally, last week, Steve, a major traffic light went out in South Pasadena, California.
Oh, that's right up the road from our
offices.
Right up
the road, yep. And a resident named Alan Ehrlich, he answered the call. He was ready for this moment. He just happened to have with him a bright orange T-shirt and a couple of orange safety flags.
What?
Because who doesn't carry those around everywhere they go?
He had those in the trunk. Wow.
He had them with him, and he got out into the intersection. He started directing traffic.
That's nice of him.
Apparently, he was quite good at it, actually. Yeah. He was able to clear up a one-mile backup in about 10 minutes.
Nice.
Now, then the police arrived,
and
they were not too happy with the situation.
I'm sure they weren't.
They actually ended up giving him a ticket, which he says was a small price to pay, probably for the experience. It was probably kind of fun. So
That's too much power, man.
I know. I'm guessing he's probably going to keep those orange flags in his car.
You know, it reminds me of the safety patrol. I was on the safety patrol when I was in the 5th and 6th grade. And it was great. I used to stand in front of the school with my orange flag.
Loved that authority.
Absolutely.
Well, there you go. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Enjoy your Tuesday. This is the Marketplace Midday Updates.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.